I'm Tracy from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Are you a small business owner or even someone who dreams of entrepreneurship? Then check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from iHeart Podcasts and Intuit QuickBooks. Join hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres as they interview entrepreneurs sharing insights around starting and nurturing a small business. You won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too.
What does every grocery store aisle now have in common? Products that come in paper packaging. And not just the obvious ones like cereal boxes and juice cartons. From beauty products to boxed water, there are more opportunities to go papertarian than ever before. So why should you? Because paper comes from a renewable resource and can be recycled up to 7 times. Simply put, it's the smart choice for the environment. And it turns out the easiest choice for you. Learn more at howlifeunfolds.com/papertarian. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
This episode is brought to you by Squarespace. Start building your website today at squarespace.com. Enter offer code HISTORY at checkout to get 10% off. Squarespace. Build it beautiful.
Welcome to Stuff You Missed in History Class from HowStuffWorks.com.
And welcome to the podcast. I'm Holly Fry.
And I'm Tracy V. Wilson.
We have an interview today, and I will tell you how this came about because it was one of those things that was serendipitous and delightful and filled me with squealing happiness. So back in the fall of last year, so 2015, there was a book that arrived at my desk. And this is nothing new because we are often sent books by publishers for review as possible interview subjects. But this book was a little bit different. One, it is huge. It was like a massive box that came. And two, once I opened this parcel, which was quite heavy, I saw the book within, and then it was this incredible book of historical fashion plates. It's titled Fashion Plates, 150 Years of Style. And the writer, April Callahan, is a fashion historian and a special collections associate at the Fashion Institute of Technology. So she really knows her stuff. And so I opened this book and I started to page through it and I just fell in love with it. I found it utterly enchanting because not only is it pictures of historical clothing, which everyone knows I love, but this is so gorgeous. And we talk about it a little bit in the interview coming up, but like the printing on it is absolutely exquisite. It is like just a fine art book. It's really, really gorgeous. And it is so pretty that other HowStuffWorks staffers started kind of wandering over to my desk to see what I was gasping over. And then they started gasping. And Julie Douglas and I stood there for a long time paging through this thing and just being amazed at how absolutely gorgeous it is and how much really cool information is contained in it. And so, of course, I, as soon as I was able to tear myself away from it, I shot off an email to ask if April would join us on the show. And then when she responded, she surprised me a little by mentioning that she had also just published another book, which is titled Fashion and the Art of Pochoir, The Golden Age of Illustration in Paris. So I was like, great, we'll talk about both of those books. So for those of you who are into historical fashion or even simply art, you are going to be delighted to hear her insights on both clothing and culture, as well as art throughout history. And she's incredibly well-spoken, and she shares some really great insights.
First up, this talk covers just exactly how somebody becomes a fashion historian, which a lot of listeners have expressed to us as their dream job, and how having a job at the Fashion Institute of Technology leads to some really exciting moments.
now that I am lucky enough to have April Callahan on the line for an interview, we're going to get right to talking about some of the amazing work she has been doing. And right out of the gate, I will tell you that one of the things I love in your Fashion Plates book, the dedication says this book is dedicated to those people who know what they love to do but haven't quite found their way. Be fearless. It seems like you have clearly found what you love to do. So before we start talking about the books and historical fashion, can you just tell us kind of what drew you to historical fashion in the first place and how you managed to make this into a career?
Sure. Yes. First of all, I just want to say thank you so much for having me. I'm really delighted to be on the show. I'm actually a fan, so it's a great compliment. So kind of how I ended up where I am here is from a very, very young age, I always was really drawn to and interested in the kind of hidden story behind objects. Who created them? Why? Who owned them? What do those objects mean to their owners? And how does that kind of speak to a creation of not only like an individual, but also a cultural identity? And my interest in that kind of led me to study art history. And I did an undergraduate degree in art history. And then after I graduated, I ended up working in contemporary art foundations and galleries as an assistant director for almost 10 years. But some point along the way there, I started to get a little bit of an itch to explore some other interests, but I wasn't certain what those interests were yet. And one day I just happened to stumble across a book that kind of changed the course of my life professionally from that point forward. And it was the catalog to the Kyoto Costume Institute. So it's a costume collection in Kyoto, Japan. And the book is published by Passion. It's pretty widely available. But
I have to laugh because I have and adore that book.
It's really great.
So
right?
I understand how it was life-changing because it's really amazing.
I mean, I devoured their presentation of the history of fashion from the 18th to the 20th century in like a 24-hour period. And from that point forward, I kind of knew what I wanted to do with the rest of my life. And I applied to graduate program here in New York in fashion and textile curatorial studies. So really, until I encountered that book, I didn't realize that one could actually study fashion, that the field of fashion studies existed, and that one you could really use an object-based approach to analyze the motives and really even the technologies of a society that created the objects.
That's so cool. And like I said, I love that book, so I really do completely understand how it shifted
good.
Everything.
Yeah, fantastic. I've given that book as a gift to so many people.
Well, and I actually received it as a gift, so it's perfect. To me, that is like a perfect gift book. And now you work in special collections at the Fashion Institute of Technology. So do you ever stumble across any fabulous fashion surprises? And how specifically did you end up there?
Well, actually, how I ended up here was I did go to graduate school here at FIT. I went back for a little while to working in art here in New York. And as I started working on these books, I was delving into this collection specifically a lot. And so I was hanging around a lot. And eventually they asked me if I'd want to come on board. So, in terms of finding really fun things within the collection, yes, this happens frequently. Our collection here at FIT is really quite robust. We have about 3,500 linear feet of rare books and periodicals specifically on the topics of fashion and design. And we also have more than 350 manuscript collections. And when I say manuscript collections, I mean unpublished materials. So in the context of the types of things that we collect, that really means designer archives. And within our paper designer archives, we estimate we have about 500,000 original works on paper, most of which are designer sketches. So one of my most serendipitous surprises that I've had recently kind of pertains to these sketch collections. And a few months ago, I had posted on our Instagram feed a photograph of this really beautiful evening dress by the couturière Lucille. And I had found the photograph in a 1917 issue of the French fashion magazine Le Mode, which is one of the rare periodicals that we have here. But the following week, I just happened to be leading a class visit with graduate students, and I had randomly gone back in the collections room and pulled a box of sketches from the many, many boxes of Lucille sketches that we have. I opened the box in front of the graduate students. The first sketch I turned to just happened to be the original sketch for the dress that I had posted on Instagram the week before.
Oh my goodness.
And what are the chances of that happening? And that's really kind of something that speaks to the vast and the scope of what we have here.
Oh, that's spectacular. I would imagine that's one of those things where sometimes you have to make yourself leave at the end of the day.
Yes.
Because it's a constant
I learn something
treasure
every single day when I come to work.
Oh, I love it. It's like a treasure hunt all the time. Mm-hmm. That always pays off, it seems. So you have two books out right now that are fresh releases, both about fashion history and specifically fashion illustration. So since mm-hmm. they came out like one right after the other, I mean, it's only a couple of weeks that separated their publication dates. Did you work on those concurrently, or did you have to kind of silo it and do one and then the other?
I actually did not work on them concurrently. I pretty much wrote them back to back, but it just happened to be an odd twist of fate that they ended up coming out at the same time. I wish I was that much of a powerhouse of a writer to be able to work on two books at the same time, but I am not.
So when you're working on a book like this, which here's where it really gets to be a little powerhousey in my head. Writing, of course, takes a lot of work. But to me, sifting through source material and the rich source material you had for each of these is a huge task. And so when you're compiling books like this, when you're curating collections, what is that process like? Like, how do you start? Where do you have a vision when you begin? And does it stay the same, or how much does it evolve as you go? And like, how long does it really take you to kind of create a cohesive assortment and cull the ones that don't quite fit and go through that whole process?
Mm-hmm. Well, since I really am like quite literally physically immersed in the materials every day when I come to work, for me, it's just kind of more about living with the materials at hand for a while and then starting to see where there is an abundance of subject matter that coincides with a gap in whatever the current publishing or scholarship that's happening is. And then once you make that connection, it's really about just diving into the original primary source materials from the period and then letting the materials tell you their story. Everyone has their own way of working, of course, but personally, I photograph obsessively. And one would think that this is kind of a simple proposition, but when you are working with a large amount of historic materials within a really massive collection, just having a simple image on your screen or on your page really isn't enough information for you to work from. You have to record all of its metadata. And what I mean by that is, you know, what publication is it from? What was the date? Who is the artist? Who is the photographer? And on a lot of this is in order to be an effective researcher later, when you go back to evaluate your pool of images that you start with. First of all, you need to know where to be returned to in order to relocate that image again after you've been doing research. And this is really super important when you have a pool of, say, 6,000 images that you start with, which is essentially what I began with when I started image selection for the Fashion Plates book. So we culled that down from 6,000 to 200.
That seems like it would be terribly painful.
There are moments, I'm not going to lie, where it is very pretty heartbreaking when you have to cut something that you love.
Well, and that's my next question. Are you good about killing your darlings and cutting those things that you just are in love with, but they maybe aren't the right fit, and kind of admitting that to yourself? Or is it like did you ever find yourself in the back of your head knowing what the right decision was, but still holding on to something that maybe you just were really attached to?
You know, I think I become better about it. and I think when I went into the second book, I had a better, clearly defined set of parameters that we agreed upon before we started working with our image pool. And those parameters, first being that specific image's ability to advance forward the story that we're trying to weave together by putting the images together. And then once we kind of have an idea of what we want and also how those things, you know, work visually together, copyright we have to consider copyright. So with the type of books that I do, which are considered illustrated books, this can really be a defining factor in which images ultimately appear. So for instance, for Fashion and the Art of Peshawar, which I wrote with my fantastic co-author, Cassidy Zachary, one of our very, very favorite illustrators of this entire time period, his name was André Edouard Marty, and his work has not transitioned into the public domain. And because the more of his work that we wanted to use, we were going to have to pay use fees for due to budget constraints, we could not include as many of his illustrations in the books as we would have liked.
Was that ever freeing to be like, the universe is deciding this for me? I don't have to make this cut.
And it's freeing as much as it was painful at other times, yes.
Oh, I can't even imagine. I cannot imagine having to cull a collection of gorgeous fashion plates down without going slightly mad or becoming really melancholy in the process. So it was good to hear from someone that has done that, how she sort of handled it. I know I get way too attached to things that I think are beautiful to ever really be able to do that with any sort of grace.
We are going to hear more from April about her book on Peshawar, and she's going to describe exactly what that is in just a moment. But first, we will have a word from one of the fabulous sponsors that keeps Stuff You Missed in History Class on the air. I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business, and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
If you use paper, you're a human. But if you choose paper, you're a papertarian, someone who lives a paper-based lifestyle because it has a positive impact on the planet. And also because it's the easiest choice you'll make all day, seriously. It's as easy as reaching for boxed instead of bottled water. It's as easy as opting for beauty products that come in paper packaging. It's as easy as grabbing eggs in a cardboard container. And that's all in one trip to the grocery store, which, if everyone's being honest, you were planning to go to anyway. But paper isn't just an easy choice. Papertarians know that it's the smart choice, too. Because paper comes from trees, a renewable and sustainably managed resource, and paper products are designed to be recycled. In fact, when you choose products that come in paper-based packaging, those fibers can go on to be recycled up to 7 times. So why wouldn't you go Papertarian? Learn more at howlifeunfolds.com/papertarian. Planning your next trip? Choice Hotels has a stay for any traveler you want to be, with 22 brands and over 7,400 locations. Whether you're a business traveler, a family road tripper, someone who wants to seek out history and maybe make your own, or just planning a quick getaway, Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. Like a Cambria Hotel, where you can be a cocktail connoisseur and sip locally inspired craft beverages at downtown locations in the center of it all. This is a fun way to visit cities with a lot of history and a lot of fun in mind. Or a Radisson Hotel, for all our productivity powerhouses out there. With flexible workspaces and on-site restaurants, you'll get the most out of your work trip. You'll get the coffee, the Wi-Fi, and the work done. And we can't forget about comfort hotels. Imagine you're a family road tripper, waking up in your big spacious room and then heading down to a free hot breakfast for the entire family, including waffles. So you'll be well-fed and ready for the day's adventure, even if that's just relaxing. After that, you're spending all afternoon relaxing by the pool. You deserve it. What are you waiting for? Join Choice Privileges and start earning points toward your next stay. Find a stay for any you. Book directly at choicehotels.com, where travels come true.
Mm-hmm.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There is still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All righty, as promised. Tracy, do you want to know what pochoir is?
I do, in fact.
All right, let's do it. So you brought up your book about pochoir. So I wanted to ask you if you would explain for our listeners what pochoir actually is.
Certainly. Of course, I'd be happy to. So pochoir literally is the French word for stencil. And stenciling as an image-making technique has existed for thousands of years. We see it employed in prehistoric cave paintings. Many millennia later, in the Middle Ages, oftentimes people who did not know how to read or write would use a stencil as a means of signing legal documents. In the 16th century, it was often used to create playing cards. But really, as a widespread technique, we really start to see it emerge in the 19th century, where it was used by Japanese artisans for creating and decorating housewares, fans, and kimono. So they were using it in textile design. And so they really cultivated the Japanese, this technique, over several hundred years. And as a lot of imported goods from Japan became quite fashionable in Europe during the latter portion of the 19th century, it's around this time that European printers also kind of start to experiment with the technique, and they really refined it even further for the purposes of not printing on textiles, but book publishing. And the technique of pochoir really sort of reached just apotheosis under the guidance and refinement of a gentleman whose name was Jean Sade. To this day, Sade is really kind of considered the authority on the pochoir technique. And the reason for this is because how he thought about color was really quite advanced. So how the pochoir process worked was an artist or an illustrator would submit to Sade and his pochoir studio an original work on paper. And this was the original work that ultimately they wanted to reproduce in a book or an album or, let's say a periodical. And the image would be really, really, really rigorously scrutinized for its color separations. Then a découpeur, or a cutter, would create stencils, at least one stencil for each color appearing within an image. And oftentimes, because of the complexity of an image, there may be more than one stencil cut for the color red. Copper and zinc were pretty much the favorite materials used to create the physical stencil itself. And then once these were realized, they would be handed off to a colorist or colorist who would painstakingly and really, really rigorously giving care to the registration of the stencils, they would apply water-based pigments or gouache directly to the page to create the image. The colorist had quite a variety of brushes and techniques that were available for their disposal in order to recreate as faithfully as possible the artist's original works. And this was really one of the aspects of pochoir that was treasured. These images are essentially semi-unique works of art on paper. This was really labor-intensive, and in turn, this made it very expensive to produce. And so at this level of kind of really refined level of pochoir, it was really only used for limited edition publications. And there was a certain cachet at the time surrounding its exclusivity. Luxury fashion publications, especially especially embrace the technique really kind of as a foil to the easily reproduced nature of fashion photography. So it was kind of a reaction to the rise of fashion photography. People were returning back to the handmade.
And it creates such stunning effects. It's really beautiful, like the way things are layered together. And as you said, it's a complete art in and of itself. And what I think is interesting about illustration in general is that in some cases, particularly in fashion, these illustrations of historical fashions have really sort of become even more iconic than the clothing. And what jumped to mind for me was Paul Poiret, who we've talked about on the podcast, and Paul Eribe. So for people who aren't especially into fashion and fashion history, they will sometimes recognize the sketches with some level of familiarity. But if you showed them a photograph of the garment, they're like, I don't know what that is. So in some ways, the imagery and the sketchwork has sort of superseded the clothing that it was meant to represent. Do you think any of those illustrators, particularly in the early 1900s, ever really conceived of the possibility that their work would be the more enduring part of the equation rather than the clothing?
They did. At least some of them did. And I'm saying yes, because depending on what publication that particular artist or illustrator was working for, their work may have never actually existed in physical form in terms of it being a garment. Some of the garments we see in some of these illustrations were always intentionally purely the invention of the illustrator. And they were actually kind of meant to inspire the direction of fashion. So they weren't necessarily reflecting what current fashion was, but they were meant to inspire the future direction of fashion. That being said, certain publications were also underwritten by some of the couture houses. And if there was a couture house underwriting that publication, the publication usually featured illustrations of their designs, their underwriters, almost exclusively. And this is the case in Gazette du Bon Temps. And Gazette du Bon Temps would pair specific illustrators with specific designers, and they would have an ongoing relationship for years at a time sometimes. But some examples of the garments that we see in some of these illustrations still do exist in museum collections. Specifically, some of the Poiret dresses that are illustrated by Eribe, there's extant examples of them in French museum collections. And here at FIT, we actually have one of the coats that Eribe illustrates for Les Robes de Paul Poiret. We have it in a different colorway. In Eribe's illustration, it's yellow, but the museum's collection example is in black. So it's a little bit of yes and a little bit of no, the answer to the question. Yes, sometimes they knew that their designs were only ever going to exist on the page, and sometimes they were also illustrating specific garments.
Well, and it's interesting, too, to think about, you know, clothing that gets worn, even if it's only for a short time, it sort of suffers its own use in some degree where, you know, textiles tend to break down. Paper has always sort of survived a little bit more, not always, but overall, I would say there, you know, we have more examples of art from various periods than we have the actual clothing that's intact. So it would make sense from that point of view. It just fascinates me that, particularly with Paul Poiret, I mean, I remember when we were researching that episode, I would show people pictures of the dresses and they'd be like, what is this weird dress? I've never seen this. And I would show them an illustration of like the same or a very similar dress. And they're like, oh, I've seen that art. I'm like, how did that separation exist? And one thing that's interesting, and you mentioned at the time that most of this art was sort of aspirational and sort of to drive the direction of the future of fashion, that, you know, now a separate artist doing fashion illustration for someone is much more unheard of. So as it's evolved away from that idea of partnerships between illustrators and clothing designers, why do you think it actually started to do that, where now designers pretty much also have to be artists for the most part?
And you know, here's the thing. It's a curious thing. I've been thinking about this a lot recently. I don't know that partnership has necessarily dissolved as much as we think that it has. Historically, not all fashion designers have sketched before they created their collections. This was not necessarily part of many of the great fashion designers of the past. Some designers even specifically employed sketch artists as part of their team to document their collections after the fact, rather than photograph them, because at certain periods of time, to photograph them would have been more expensive than to have a sketch artist on staff. For instance, Lucille, Lady Duff Gordon, who I mentioned earlier, she actually had dedicated sketch artists as part of her team. And one of them happened to be Edward Molyneux, who, if you know a lot about the history of fashion, he actually went on to become a very, very famous fashion designer in his own right after kind of beginning his career working for Lucille. But still to this day, I'm still bringing in fashion illustrations into our collection that are not necessarily executed by the head designers themselves, but other parties that are hired in to illustrate the production of a specific house. I think that there's kind of beginning to be sort of a resurgence of interest in fashion illustration as a reaction to all the photographic images that we're really bombarded with every single day. And it's an interesting time period because this really is kind of paralleling the interest in pochoir illustrations that was a counterpoint to the mass conversion to photography that we saw happen a century ago. I'm starting to see this happen again.
Which is fascinating because we're right at about 100 years, like since this was taking place then. So it's very, very fascinating. I loved hearing the idea that fashion illustration existing separate from fashion design is something that's having a resurgence.
It was also really interesting to hear about how illustrators of the early 1900s viewed their work in relation to the clothing designers they were collaborating with.
Yeah, I was surprised by that. So next up, the conversation is going to turn to a little bit more general talk about fashion in the context of cultural history. But first, we're going to have a word from one of our fabulous sponsors.
I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
If you use paper, you're a human. But if you choose paper, you're a papertarian, someone who lives a paper-based lifestyle because it has a positive impact on the planet. And also because it's the easiest choice you'll make all day, seriously. It's as easy as reaching for boxed instead of bottled water. It's as easy as opting for beauty products that come in paper packaging. It's as easy as grabbing eggs in a cardboard container. And that's all in one trip to the grocery store, which, if everyone's being honest, you were planning to go to anyway. But paper isn't just an easy choice. Papertarians know that it's the smart choice, too. Because paper comes from trees, a renewable and sustainably managed resource, and paper products are designed to be recycled. In fact, when you choose products that come in paper-based packaging, those fibers can go on to be recycled up to 7 times. So why wouldn't you go Papertarian? Learn more at howlifeunfolds.com/papertarian. Planning your next trip? Choice Hotels has a stay for any traveler you want to be, with 22 brands and over 7,400 locations. Whether you're a business traveler, a family road tripper, someone who wants to seek out history and maybe make your own, or just planning a quick getaway, Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. Like a Cambria Hotel, where you can be a cocktail connoisseur and sip locally inspired craft beverages at downtown locations in the center of it all. This is a fun way to visit cities with a lot of history and a lot of fun in mind. Or a Radisson Hotel, for all our productivity powerhouses out there. With flexible workspaces and on-site restaurants, you'll get the most out of your work trip. You'll get the coffee, the Wi-Fi, and the work done. And we can't forget about comfort hotels. Imagine you're a family road trip or waking up in your big spacious room and then heading down to a free hot breakfast for the entire family, including waffles. So you'll be well-fed and ready for the day's adventure, even if that's just relaxing. After that, you're spending all afternoon relaxing by the pool. You deserve it. What are you waiting for? Join Choice Privileges and start earning points toward your next stay. Find a stay for any you. Book directly at choicehotels.com, where travels come true. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There is still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, next, April will talk about fashion in a cultural context, and then they will wrap up, she and Holly, with some advice about how other people interested in fashion history might start out if they are wanting to learn more.
You mentioned earlier in our discussion that you really love the idea of objects and gleaning from them sort of their meaning and their context historically. So I'm curious what you think fashion can really teach us about the culture and time that it comes from. Like, as we approach it, how should we be looking at it to really interpret the period that it existed in a contemporary way?
Sure. So I think one of the things that I first realized when I really started studying fashion, and some of this is a little bit school of the obvious, but how inextricably tied fashion is to not only capitalism, but also the passage of time. In the fashion plates book, I use this little analogy that admittedly is perhaps on the verge of waxing a little bit poetic, but I like this analogy. I wrote something to the effect that fashion is not only the devoted mistress of capitalism, constantly cannibalizing itself and because of that calling for a rapid infusion of the new, but fashion is also concurrently the fickle wife of Father Time. You know, fashion is always betraying his every movement with her incessant remakeover of the physical world. So I guess what I'm trying to get at is that fashion, whether it be fashion in clothes, in colors, home goods, trends in food, or even like the apps that are on your phone, all of these things have a very specific place in this broader fashion system. And our consumption of these things is really directly connected to our personal politics vis-a-vis how we decide to vote for the creation of goods that come into being via our exchange of monetary currency for those things, right? We're voting with our dollar when we buy things. So another thing I think that we can learn from about just looking at fashion is you can always end up learning something about the technology of the period, because ultimately how things look is one of the factors that goes into how things look is always going to be the technology that was behind its creation. For instance, the invention of synthetic dyes in really changed the color palette of the late 19th century. And to me, this is kind of akin to what I think may happen very shortly here in terms of how 3D printing may very well revolutionize how we produce fashion in the coming years.
So cool. I'm literally still paging through your book while we talk, and I just keep finding myself sighing and gasping, which makes me wonder, because I'm, of course, I keep flipping to the late bustle part of the Victorian era. What is your favorite historical period in fashion? You were exposed to all of it all the time, so surely you must have a favorite.
I do, but you know what that favorite is? It shifts over time.
Oh, right.
And I kind of find that, question often depends on what I'm working on at the moment. And if I had to answer that question right now, I would definitely say that the 19 teens are at the top of my list. But I also realize that that probably has a lot to do with the fact that I've been working in that time period recently. But one of the things that I love about the teens is that it's a really, truly a pivotal point, both in the history of fashion itself and also fashion illustration. This is a time period when we start to see the corset disappear, and the corset had dominated women's fashion and in some degrees men's fashion too in certain small segments for 400 years. And it's also a really pivotal point in how fashion illustration changes with that collaboration that you referenced earlier between Poiret and Arrive. But the teens is the fact that I, as a fashion historian, one of my specific interests is in the intersection of war and fashion. So the French Revolution, World War One, World War II. And I feel very drawn to these questions around those time periods. It's like, how is it that a specific society navigates the exigencies of war with the same time having the very real need to put clothes on human bodies, but also the economic imperatives of the fashion industry in terms of keeping people employed and feeding their families during these very difficult periods? And I think that the argument that fashion is frivolous during periods of war begins to melt away just a little bit, that when you realize that, for instance, during World War One, approximately 30% of France's labor force was tethered in one way or another to the fashion industry. At that time, France was the global arbiter of style, so it wasn't only the jobs of, let's say, couture house workers that were at stake during World War One, but it was also the entire textile industry, including dye manufacturers and all of these little offshoot industries such as lace makers, embroiderers, people who worked in the feather industries, furs, millinery, the list goes on. So when you think about these intersections of war and fashion, it's not only an aesthetic choice that's happening, that there's an economic imperative behind it.
I love it. I have to wonder, do you ever do any historical costuming?
I don't. I don't. I'm terrible. I'm a terrible fashion historian. I don't even know how to sew.
What? No, that doesn't seem terrible at all to me. I'm always a little bit, just because of my own like life context, when someone says, particularly someone who is interested in fashion or whatever, says they don't sew, it seems so bizarre to me, even though it's not. But it's just because I've always been a stitcher my whole life. Like, I started when I was very, very tiny. So I'm like, of course you sew. Nobody sews. Okay. but that's just my own context that makes that seem weird. But no, I certainly know lots of people that are into fashion and don't sew, but part of it for me is the drive. Like, I want that. Mm-hmm. So I have to figure out how to make it.
There are plenty of times when I look at a fashion plate and was like, if I knew how to sew, I would be wearing that to work tomorrow.
Oh, well, what's really, really fascinating to me, going back and occasionally looking at historical patterns, I don't know how much pattern gazing you do. It's so fascinating because particularly, and again, I'll admit Victorian is my favorite zone, but you'll look at these garments and particularly in fashion plates and be like, how on earth did they ever do that? And then I'm always sort of amazed at the beautiful simplicity of engineering that usually goes into them. Where it's like, oh, this is not a hard thing to cut out at all. It has weird seams that aren't like in the places we would do modern garments, but it's usually so smart and so much more simple than one would anticipate. Yet it creates these incredible, beautiful drapes and shapes. And I'm always very wowed by the brilliance of the architecture a lot of times of historical garments. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
So I know we have a lot of listeners that are into fashion and maybe don't know quite where to get started looking into it. What would you recommend as a good starting point for someone who wants to start looking into fashion history, either for themselves or even as a potential education and career path?
Sure. Well, there's not only been an explosion of publishing on fashion studies, not only fashion history, but also fashion theory in the last decade. And hand in hand with that, an explosion of programs where you can actually go study fashion from a scholarly perspective. Here in New York, at least, there's a program at NYU. There's a program at Parsons. We have a graduate program here at FIT. Those are just three in New York. There's many programs abroad in Europe, in London. But in terms of books, of course, would be the easiest way to kind of get your feet wet. And I mentioned earlier the book that I kind of led me to being a fashion historian, and you have a copy yourself, which is the Kyoto Costume Institute catalog. I think technically the name of it is something like Fashion, a History from the 18th to 20th Century, something like that.
Yeah, and I know I have the paperback version, which is two volumes. Mm-hmm. Like it was two volumes in a box set, so, and I think that got a rename possibly. So we'll look it up and put it in the show notes.
Okay. Yeah. There's another great book that's a fantastic overview of fashion history that just came out, I think, in October. It's called The History of Modern Fashion, and it's by Daniel Cole and Nancy Deal. And it covers fashion from the birth of haute couture in the 1850s all the way into the 21st century. So it's a pretty wide-spanning book. Those would be two of my top picks for just a very smart but easy overview of a lot of time.
Well, and the Kyoto one, I know for sure, like, it's an easy entry because you'll first just sit there slack-jawed at all the gorgeous photography for a while, and
exactly.
Then you'll start reading the notes.
That book actually was the structure of it was a little bit of my inspiration for how I set up the Fashion Place book. You have it there in front of you, so you already know this, but I didn't write text-heavy chapters. I really wanted a lot of people coming from lots of different backgrounds or with a lot of different interests to be able to access the book on whatever level that they wanted. So I didn't want to do these text-heavy chapters. Instead, I kind of did vignettes. And so an image, the Fashion Plate itself, will be on one page, and facing that will be this sort of like contextualizing text that may be about the history of fashion that's portrayed in the Fashion Plate. It may be about the social political climate of that particular era. It may be about art history or technology of the period that's kind of evidencing its hand within the Fashion Plate. But these things are really of utmost importance to me when trying to understand what fashion's true relevance is within any given era. It's much broader than just the clothes themselves. It's all these other things surrounding it that go into its creation.
And I would actually add your Fashion Plates book particularly to a good starter point because, as you said, it's so it's laid out in such a way that it's kind of easy to digest it in whatever manner you desire. But it's kind of one of those things where even if you start looking at the pictures, when it first came, one of my colleagues, Julie Douglas, who works on other podcasts and projects here at How Stuff Works, she is into fashion, but is not really into fashion history so much. She just hasn't been exposed to it. And we're sitting there paging through it and gasping at the loveliness. And then we would be gazing at a picture, and then I would see her kind of drifting over to the text side and be like, oh, now I understand. And so it's sort of it really is a beautiful kind of a way to introduce people to some of the context socially, particularly that otherwise you may miss just looking at the gorgeous pictures. So thank you for that.
Well, thank you so much for saying that because that was exactly my intent.
Hooray! Success! Oh, April, thank you so much for being with us. I cannot tell you how much I appreciate your time and also just getting to chat with you about fashion history.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure, and I hope you enjoy the book more.
Oh, I'm sure I will. I am going to take it home from the office now that we're done with this, and then I can truly devour it in my own time. And I super love it and really would recommend it to anybody who is into fashion. The holidays are over, but it would make a spectacular gift for anybody. If you're late or if there's a birthday coming, do that. And otherwise, thank you so much for being here. Where can people find you online?
I do have a blog that I write as part of my job here at FIT, which is called Material Mode. And you can just search, Google search blog Material Mode FIT, and I'm sure it'll come up. And then you can also follow us on Instagram. We have a fantastic Instagram feed, which we post really cool things from the collection every day, 5 days a week. And you can follow us at FIT Special Collections on Instagram.
And I am now following you. excellent. Well, thank you so, so much. And we hopefully we'll talk to you next time you have a book out.
Thanks. I would love to.
Most excellent. So that was the amazing April Callahan. Her books, once again, if you want to check them out, and if you're into fashion history at all, you do want to check them out, are Fashion Plates, 150 Years of Style, and the other one is Fashion and the Art of Pochoir, The Golden Age of Illustration in Paris. And I am not joking at all when I talk about how gorgeous these books are. Like, I may sound like I'm overblowing it. I'm not. They're absolutely spectacular. And I am so delighted that April shared some of her fashion history knowledge with us.
Holly, do you also have some listener mail?
I do. And since we have just wrapped up the holidays and we recorded, we kind of front loaded a lot of episodes going into the holidays so that you could take some time off. And I took some time off of recording, but I was working on scripts and stuff. So, we had a lot of like really great holiday mail coming to the office, but we didn't get to shout it out during the holidays. So I wanted to do a few of those now. One of these, we mentioned them last year, this wonderful couple, Zach and Paloma, who are delights. I adore these people. They do these really fun, kooky photoshops for their cards. And this year, they have several pictures of them and their cats, but they have switched the heads on their cats to be them and vice versa. So it's very funny because they did a very good job of it. And then there's one on the back where they have just switched each other's heads. And it's so cute. And I love that they include us in their card list because this is one that I just smile like crazy when it came in. And then I shared it around the office. Caroline from Stuff Mom Never Told You and I giggled over this for probably a good 10 minutes. Another one that I wanted to shout out to was our listener, Fergal from Ireland, who I shared the image of his wonderful gift that he sent us on social. But in case anybody wasn't looking at that, Fergal sent us these beautiful mugs from Ireland, and it was so nice. He lives in the Hill of Tara in County Meath, which is seat of the former High Kings of Ireland and home to Maguire's Cafe and Gift Shop. And they really, in his opinion, deserve a call out if possible. So he got us these fabulous mugs to kind of make mention of them. So we appreciate it. I love it. I'm using mine frequently here at the office. I really appreciate it. Fergal, that was so kind to send that all the way across the pond for us. We also got a wonderful card. And I won't read the whole thing, and I can't give you the person's name because they only signed it with their initials and they didn't put a return address. But it's a beautiful card featuring two puffins with some lovely Christmas lights. And this listener talks about how they have historically had a little bit of a problem listening to people speak extemporaneously, but how like they're kind of working through it, and our podcast has been part of that. So I really appreciate it. I know there could be moments where you cringe listening to people talk. I do sometimes. That's fine. So I super appreciate it. Thank you so much. The other shout out that I want to give is another repeat from last year, but Nicole from yearofthecalendar.com once again sent us gorgeous, fabulous planners. And as everyone knows, I'm a planner junkie. I'm already so excited for my 2016 planner. It's so kind and generous when people send us stuff like this. I really cannot convey enough how much I appreciate just the fact that someone thinks of us and wants to share part of their world with us. And in cases like Nicole's, part of their, you know, art. It's fabulous. So thank you so much to everybody. I know there were other people that sent us great cards and gifts, and we, as we always sort of lament, we don't have time to list or talk about all of them, but I'm so appreciative. It is super awesome. If you would like to get in touch with us, you can email us at historypodcast@howstuffworks.com. You can also reach us at facebook.com/MissedInHistory, on Twitter @MissedInHistory, at pinterest.com/MissedInHistory, at missedinhistory.tumblr.com, and on Instagram @MissedInHistory. If you would like to learn a little bit more about today's topic, you can go to our parent site, HowStuffWorks, type in the words fashion history, and one of the really cool things that comes up is actually a gallery called The Changing Tides of Fashion. It kind of looks at different moments in fashion throughout the years. If you would like to visit us, you can do that at mistinhistory.com. And there you will find show notes for all of the episodes since Tracy and I have been working on the podcast, as well as all of the archived episodes with all of the hosts that preceded us. And so once again, come and visit us at howstuffworks.com and mistinhistory.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
Hey guys, you know what this playground could use? A wine country, huh?
A redwood forest would be cool.
Ski slopes!
Wait!
Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
This is it. We've got an Amex Platinum Pro on our hands, ladies and gentlemen. We haven't seen anyone relax like this before in the Centurion Lounge. Is he connecting to complimentary Wi-Fi? Oh, my. Look at that. He is. And you will not believe where he's going next. The Amex dedicated card member entrance for the win. Unbelievable.
When you get travel perks with Amex Platinum, you're part of the action. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.